Próba nyelvvizsga verseny középfokú nyelvvizsgával már rendelkező középiskolás diákok számára. Angol nyelv.
Part 1. You are going to hear a radio program introducing the famous Eltham Palace in England, which was bought and renovated by Steve and Virginia Courtauld in the 1930s. While listening, choose the correct answer. There is an example, 0, at the beginning. You are going to hear the text twice. Do as much as you can the first time, and finish your work the second time. Finally, you are going to have 60 seconds to complete your answers. Now you have 2 minutes to study the sentences below.
Now listen to the recording.
Hello, I'm Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, and this is my personal guide to the extraordinary Eltham Palace. There's been some sort of building here at Eltham Palace for almost 1,000 years. Eltham was extended and transformed into one of the most important medieval palaces in England. But sadly, it fell out of favour in the 16th century, and the beautiful building fell into decay. In 1933, wealthy textile heir Stephen Courtauld and his wife Virginia bought the crumbling property. Incredibly rich, he inherited a fortune in shares in his family's textile business. Virginia was the daughter of an Italian father and a Hungarian mother. They were an unlikely couple. She, vivacious, impulsive, and chic. He, cautious and reserved. But together, they were hugely popular and the ultimate party hosts for the 1930s jet set. This was a favourite weekend haunt of politicians, architects, explorers, racing drivers, film stars, and the royals. What the Courtaulds wanted here was a party palace, everything conceived for comfort and convenience. And as your glamorous guests arrived, of course, the first comfort they required was a convenience. Ladies, and then gents, allowing the freshly arrived jet set to reapply or check a tie before making their grand entrance. Into this, the very epitome of Art Deco luxury. It's extravagant in its understatement, elegant in its chic. It's an haute couture interior that's crowned, quite literally like a modernist cathedral, by this dome of concrete and glass. The dining room, the heart of the Courtauld social scene. In the dining room, the Courtaulds wanted a space that put the mmm in moderne and the per in perfect. Everything had to be bang up to the minute for the time, even the technology. This is one of the first electric fires in the country, and the lighting, possibly inspired by the movie industry, bounces off a silver leaf ceiling, which is so much more flattering. Even the chairs were designed to flatter, their rose pink colour chosen especially to set off the ladies' dresses as they dined. The Great Hall. To find out more about how this room evolved, I met with the man who wrote the guidebook on Eltham, Michael Turner.
This building was started in the 1470s by Edward IV as his great hall for a new great hall for the palace. And the earlier great hall was getting a bit too small, it was very run down, and Edward IV's idea was to create a hall that was big enough to allow the entire court to sit down here and eat, maybe 800 people. Stephen had a dark room in the basement where he could develop photographs. Yeah. Yes, so I think here we've got Stockholm, which they went to in the 1920s, and this is Ostberg's town hall, which was completed in the early 20s, and there are lots of references
of
to this building.
That's in the entrance hall.
This is in the entrance hall, because the entrance hall
is part of the marquetry.
Absolutely, it's designed by a Swedish architect anyway.
So in a way, we can trace a lot of the personal details that crop up in the architecture through their photograph albums, because they're all references to, you know, experiences they've had, places they've been, travels that they've shared together.
And they were very keen gardeners. I mean, Stephen was a wonderful horticulturalist and ended up propagating a lot of orchids here, for example. They wanted somewhere where they could lay out a fantastic garden. They wanted somewhere with a huge space that could be used for entertaining, and yet they also wanted space to lay out a very modern home with all the conveniences that they required.
Close to the bedrooms on the upper floor were Ma Zhong's living quarters. Nothing was too good for Zhongyi. His quarters boasted central heating, delicately painted palm trees, and a trapdoor through which he could scuttle down to the flower room, thence to terrorise the guests.
Now you have 30 seconds to check and complete your work. Listen to the recording again.
Hello, I'm Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, and this is my personal guide to the extraordinary Eltham Palace. There's been some sort of building here at Eltham Palace for almost 1,000 years. Eltham was extended and transformed into one of the most important medieval palaces in England. But sadly, it fell out of favour in the 16th century, and the beautiful building fell into decay. In 1933, wealthy textile heir Stephen Courtauld and his wife Virginia bought the crumbling property. Incredibly rich, he inherited a fortune in shares in his family's textile business. Virginia was the daughter of an Italian father and a Hungarian mother. They were an unlikely couple. She, vivacious, impulsive, and chic. he cautious and reserved. But together they were hugely popular and the ultimate party hosts for the 1930s jet set. This was a favourite weekend haunt of politicians, architects, explorers, racing drivers, film stars, and the royals. What the Courtaulds wanted here was a party palace, everything conceived for comfort and convenience. And as your glamorous guests arrived, of course, the first comfort they required was a convenience. Ladies, and then gents, allowing the freshly arrived jet set to reapply or check a tie before making their grand entrance. Into this, the very epitome of Art Deco luxury. It's extravagant in its understatement, elegant in its chic. It's an haute couture interior that's crowned, quite literally like a modernist cathedral, by this dome of concrete and glass. The dining room, the heart of the Courtauld social scene. In the dining room, the Courtaulds wanted a space that put the in modern and the per in perfect. Everything had to be bang up to the minute for the time, even the technology. This is one of the first electric fires in the country, and the lighting, possibly inspired by the movie industry, bounces off a silver leaf ceiling, which is so much more flattering. Even the chairs were designed to flatter. Their rose pink colour chosen especially to set off the ladies' dresses as they dined. The Great Hall. To find out more about how this room evolved, I met with the man who wrote the guidebook on Eltham, Michael Turner.
This building was started in the 1470s by Edward IV as his great hall for a new great hall for the palace. And the earlier great hall was getting a bit too small, it was very run down, and Edward IV's idea was to create a hall that was big enough to allow the entire court to sit down here and eat maybe 800 people. Stephen had a dark room in the basement where he could develop photographs. Yeah. Yes, so I think here we've got Stockholm, which they went to in the 1920s, and this is Ostberg's town hall, which was completed in the early 20s, and there are lots of references
of
to this building.
That's in the entrance hall.
This is in the entrance hall, because the entrance hall
is part of the market room.
Absolutely, it's designed by a Swedish architect anyway.
So in a way, we can trace a lot of the personal details that crop up in the architecture through their photograph albums, because they're all references to, you know, experiences they've had, places they've been, travels that they've shared together.
And they were very keen gardeners. I mean, Stephen was a wonderful horticulturalist and ended up propagating a lot of orchids here, for example. They wanted somewhere where they could lay out a fantastic garden. They wanted somewhere with a huge space that could be used for entertaining, and yet they also wanted space to lay out a very modern home with all the conveniences that they required.
Close to the bedrooms on the upper floor were Ma Zhong's living quarters. Nothing was too good for Zhongyi. His quarters boasted central heating, delicately painted palm trees, and a trapdoor through which he could scuttle down to the flower room, thence to terrorise the guests.
Now you have 1 minute to check and complete your work. This is the end of part one.
Part two. You're going to hear a radio program about college education in the USA. Listen to the text and finish the sentences with a few words. There's an example zero at the beginning. You're going to hear the text twice. Do as much as you can the first time and finish your work the second time. Finally, you're going to have 60 seconds to complete your answers. Now you have 2 minutes to study the sentences below.
Now listen to the recording.
The current economy with a high unemployment rate is among the reasons more Americans seem to be asking, is a college degree really worth it? Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's spent a career thinking about the value of a college education. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
So recognizing the answer might be complicated, why should students and their families go into hock for hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a job that might pay less than what they paid for tuition?
Well, you know, I think maybe the place to start is with the hundreds of thousands of dollars part. You know, it's unfortunate that we set our sights on the top 20, 30 universities in the United States when we think about going to college. And by top, I mean the ones that get the highest rankings in U.S. News and World Report, the ones that have the most cachet. But there are thousands upon thousands of other institutions of higher learning, public institutions of higher learning, where it costs a whole lot less and where you can get a decent education. And unfortunately, I think people are kind of guided away from them because they're quote-unquote low status. They're not going to lead anywhere, but it's just not true.
There are undoubtedly benefits other than vocational to a college education, but I'm wondering if it's harder in a time like this to get people to focus on that.
I mean, you know, we respond to the threat that's most imminent, right? I mean, that's the way we survive. It's part of human nature. So it makes complete sense that when we listen to public policy spokespeople, when we listen to our legislators, that virtually the only reason we hear to get an education is an economic one. You know, we need to prepare students for the 21st century economy, and we need to educate our citizenry so that we can regain the kind of economic preeminence that we held for so long. All of that is understandable. What concerns me, Scott, is that it can also narrow our vision. If all we talk about, as we've been doing for decades now, is the economic payoff of education, that ends up affecting finally what we teach and how we teach it. Mm. It ends up affecting the way we define what it means to be educated.
Well, and remind us of some of those benefits.
You know, historically, there's been many other justifications for education in our country that, in fact, have trumped the economic one. I mean, for many, many years, the civic and moral purpose of mass education was trumpeted. Mm-hmm. You know, the Jeffersonian ideal, right? That to have a functioning democracy, you need an educated citizenry. So that kind of civic purpose of education has certainly been important. The idea of intellectual growth, that is, not just learning things to make a living, but also learning things to enable you to do things with your life, to enable you to find interests and pursuits that in some way or another maybe, you know, expand the way you see things. There's a social benefit to it, for sure. Learning to think together, learning to attack problems together, learning how to disagree, being exposed to other points of view. So there's these kind of multiple reasons that historically have played in and out of our justifications for schooling.
Is it harder, though, to get people to cherish the value of the Jeffersonian ideal when they're working as a barista?
That's a really good point. But maybe that's exactly the time when they should be thinking about the Jeffersonian ideal. That is, the kind of education that would enable you to think about the politics and economics that have you working in a Starbucks. You know, to be able to think about our economic situation in some kind of a analytical and sophisticated way is not something that comes easy, and I think it does come with study.
What's the effect of students being able to look at people like Bill Gates and Jeff Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs? And they're pretty prominent college dropouts who will say college was just not meeting my needs. And they can finish that sentence by saying, and now I'm one of the most successful people in the world.
I am absolutely not a person who says one size fits all. In arguing for some kind of education beyond high school, I'm not just talking about the regular four-year liberal arts degree. I mean, I think a lot of remarkable stuff happens in occupational programs, in two-year college programs. You know, the Bill Gateses, the Zuckerbergs. They're rare, and I think we have to be careful about generalizing from rare examples.
Is college still valuable for giving students a space to experiment?
Some of the students I work with in a poor urban community college right now, boy, they don't have time to experiment, right? I mean, they are desperately trying to build the skills to be able to get a better toehold on the economy. So let's first admit that the good fortune to be able to experiment isn't available to everybody just in terms of, you know, your income background. But that notion of college as being a place to try things on makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I see it so often. Young people come in, they have an idea for a major, and then they take that astronomy class, or they take that history class, or they take that literature class, or a dance class, and boom, a light goes on for them, and they find a passion.
Mike Rose, a professor of education at UCLA, author of several books about education, including The Mind at Work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Now you have 1 minute to check and complete your work.
Listen to the recording again.
The current economy with a high unemployment rate is among the reasons more Americans seem to be asking, is a college degree really worth it? Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's spent a career thinking about the value of a college education. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
So recognizing the answer might be complicated, why should students and their families go into hock for hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a job that might pay less than what they paid for tuition?
Well, you know, I think maybe the place to start is with the hundreds of thousands of dollars part. You know, it's unfortunate that we set our sights on the top 20, 30 universities in the United States when we think about going to college. And by top, I mean the ones that get the highest rankings in U.S. News and World Report, the ones that have the most cachet. But there are thousands upon thousands of other institutions of higher learning, public institutions of higher learning, where it costs a whole lot less and where you can get a decent education. And unfortunately, I think people are kind of guided away from them because they're quote-unquote low status. They're not going to lead anywhere, but it's just not true.
There are undoubtedly benefits other than vocational to a college education, but I'm wondering if it's harder in a time like this to get people to focus on that.
I mean, you know, we respond to the threat that's most imminent, right? I mean, that's the way we survive. It's part of human nature. So it makes complete sense that when we listen to public policy spokespeople, when we listen to our legislators, that virtually the only reason we hear to get an education is an economic one. You know, we need to prepare students for the 21st century economy, and we need to educate our citizenry so that we can regain the kind of economic preeminence that we held for so long. All of that is understandable. What concerns me, Scott, is that it can also narrow our vision. If all we talk about, as we've been doing for decades now, is the economic payoff of education, that ends up affecting finally what we teach and how we teach it. Hmm. It ends up affecting the way we define what it means to be educated.
Well, and remind us of some of those benefits.
You know, historically, there's been many other justifications for education in our country that, in fact, have trumped the economic one. I mean, for many, many years, the civic and moral purpose of mass education was trumpeted. Mm-hmm. You know, the Jeffersonian ideal, right? That to have a functioning democracy, you need an educated citizenry. So that kind of civic purpose of education has certainly been important. The idea of intellectual growth, that is, not just learning things to make a living, but also learning things to enable you to do things with your life, to enable you to find interests and pursuits that in some way or another maybe, you know, expand the way you see things. There's a social benefit to it, for sure. Learning to think together, learning to attack problems together, learning how to disagree, being exposed to other points of view. So there's these kind of multiple reasons that historically have played in and out of our justifications for schooling.
Is it harder, though, to get people to cherish the value of the Jeffersonian ideal when they're working as a barista?
That's a really good point. But maybe that's exactly the time when they should be thinking about the Jeffersonian ideal. That is, the kind of education that would enable you to think about the politics and economics that have you working in a Starbucks. You know, to be able to think about our economic situation in some kind of an analytical and sophisticated way is not something that comes easy, and I think it does come with study.
What's the effect of students being able to look at people like Bill Gates and Jeff Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs? And they're pretty prominent college dropouts who will say college was just not meeting my needs. And they can finish that sentence by saying, and now I'm one of the most successful people in the world.
I am absolutely not a person who says one size fits all. In arguing for some kind of education beyond high school, I'm not just talking about the regular four-year liberal arts degree. I mean, I think a lot of remarkable stuff happens in occupational programs, in two-year college programs. You know, the Bill Gateses, the Zuckerbergs. They're rare, and I think we have to be careful about generalizing from rare examples.
Is college still valuable for giving students a space to experiment?
Some of the students I work with in a poor urban community college right now, boy, they don't have time to experiment, right? I mean, they are desperately trying to build the skills to be able to get a better toehold on the economy. So let's first admit that the good fortune to be able to experiment isn't available to everybody just in terms of, you know, your income background. But that notion of college as being a place to try things on makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I see it so often. Young people come in, they have an idea for a major, and then they take that astronomy class, or they take that history class, or they take that literature class, or a dance class, and boom, a light goes on for them, and they find a passion.
Mike Rose, a professor of education at UCLA, author of several books about education, including The Mind at Work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Now you have 1 minute to check and complete your work. This is the end of the listening task.